Space with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 46th episode of Robots. In today's episode, we speak with the lead scientist of the SPHERES project, Dr. Alvar Sainz-Otero from MIT. SPHERES are basically amazing-looking basketball-sized satellites that are being used to investigate formation flying and docking in space. These robots have even been tested in zero gravity during parabolic flights and on board the ISS, to the astronauts' delight.
We then go to Adam, who will be dissecting one of the best-known definitions of a robot, dating back from 1979. But first, since the airline strikes here in Europe have left Christine stranded on the other side of the world, Adam and I will be telling you about the latest news in robotics. The inadvertent online posting of a video broke news on an ambitious project by researchers at MIT's Sensible City and Aeris Labs in the US this week. The FlyFire project aims to use a large number of self-organizing microhelicopters, each containing a small LED, to display three-dimensional images. The project has constructed a prototype helicopter with two counter-rotating propellers carrying a small transparent sphere that can take different colors on command. A computer simulation shows about 200 spheres used as smart pixels for two-dimensional images, such as a picture of Mona Lisa, as well as three-dimensional shapes such as curved surfaces, cubes, or clouds of swarming pixels. According to the researchers, the project serves as an initial step to explore and imagine the possibilities of this free-form display, a swarm of pixels in space.
Researchers at the University of Michigan have created an artificial foot for amputees that recycles energy currently wasted in between steps. The advanced prosthetic uses a combination of springs and clutches controlled by a microcontroller to reduce the almost 25% energy penalty amputees incur with conventional prosthetic feet. The new foot is currently being tested on amputees, and a commercial device is on its way.
Following a series of tests, South Korea has now decided to go ahead with introducing robotic teaching assistants nationwide. A series of videos shows how the robots developed by Korea's Institute of Science and Technology, KIST, interact with children. Most interaction is centered around conversational examples, including such themes as at the convenience store, at the hospital or pharmacy, in the gymnasium, using recognition software to provide feedback on children's pronunciation of pre-scripted answers. Other examples include the robot asking children to shop for specific items by passing them by the robot's onboard scanner, or singing songs. The new system, dubbed R Learning, will be introduced into 500 preschools in 2011 and rapidly expanded to cover 8,000 early childhood education centers by 2013. Korea sees multiple advantages in the technology, such as allowing for one-on-one lessons for children, and has plans to export R Learning to international market, beginning with developing nations. As always, more information on this episode's news, including FlyFire Project, the artificial foot, and Korea's plans for R Learning, can be found on the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Dr. Alvar Sainz-Otero is the lead scientist of the SPHERES project at MIT, which stands for Synchronized Position Hold, Engage, and Reorient Experimental Satellites. His amazing little satellites are being used to study how multiple satellites can work together in space by physically joining or docking and by flying in formations. Amazingly, these satellites have actually been successfully tested in space aboard the ISS, displaying graceful ballet-like behaviors. As if making space robots is not difficult enough, Alvar tells us what it takes to get several of them working together.
Hi, Alvar. Welcome to Robots.
Thank you very much.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My full name is Alvar Sanz-Otero. I'm a research scientist at the MIT Space Systems Laboratory. I got my PhD from MIT back in 2005, and also a couple degrees in undergrad from here. My job at the Space Systems Laboratory is to be the lead scientist of the SPHERES project.
What is the SPHERES project?
The SPHERES project is a set of microsatellites. Actually, they're nanosatellites. They're very small satellites that fly inside the International Space Station. By nanosatellite, we mean they're less than 10 kilograms. They're actually 4 kilograms approximately. And they're about the size of a basketball. So they're reasonably small. But they only fly inside the International Space Station. And they fly inside there so that we can do a lot of tests with them and never worry about getting them lost. The idea is that we really don't know how to control satellites when there's many of them trying to work together and do one specific task. For example, people might have heard of sparse aperture radar, where you have many radars located in different locations, and if you know really precisely where the radars are, you can combine the information from all of them and get a better image. The same happens with space telescopes. So while we know how to control satellites that are there in, or where they are, for example, GPS satellites, we know where they are really, really well. But that's like one at a time. So the idea is, how do we learn how to control many satellites working together?
And who's working on this project?
Well, the main science leader is MIT. But we do open the project to many groups of people. We have, as could be expected, many laboratories from NASA, laboratories like JPL, Goddard Space Flight Center, Kennedy Space Center. They're all doing some research with us on SPHERES. There's also the DOD, the Air Force Research Lab, and the Naval Postgraduate School. And we have some industry working on it. There's different contracts, so I'm trying to not say the exact industry names because of the different contracts issues, but we have industry working on the project too. The other person that is working with us, which is the industry, is what we call our industry partner, which is Aurora Flight Sciences, where basically at MIT we think of all the research and the design of the different things we're doing, and when we have to build something, we send it off to Aurora to be built because they have the facilities to meet all of the NASA safety standards and so on.
Can you describe these 4-kilo basketball-like satellites to us, the sensors, actuators, etc.?
Sure. They are, like I mentioned, about 20 centimeters in diameter, 22 centimeters, just about the size of a basketball. And they are what we call a satellite bus. So in the aerospace engineering field, we define this thing called a satellite bus, which is the different subsystems that are shared among all satellites. Pretty much no matter what type of full functional satellite you find out there, they're going to have the following subsystems, and that's structures, they're going to have communications, they're going to have power, computers, they're going to have some form of attitude and navigation system. So everything that would be common to any other satellites we have on SPHERES. So we have a propulsion system in the satellites, which is based on cold gas. It's based on compressed carbon dioxide. And the way they work is we have 12 nozzles located around the satellites, and when the satellites need to move around, they will open the thrusters and the gas comes out, and that pushes them around. In the ground, that may seem very, very hard to do because we have gravity and friction and all those things, but once we're inside space station where it's in microgravity and really the only thing that kind of stops you is the fact that it's floating in air, but that's very little drag, very little resistance, so we can move around very easily in space station just with a little bit of cold gas. The communications are wireless so that the satellites can float around, and we added omnidirectional antennas so that they can be moving wherever they need to in whatever attitude, whatever direction they need to go. and we can communicate with them. The computer is somewhat of an old computer because the satellites were built back in 1999. That's when they were first designed. And the current versions, like ISS, they were built in 2001. So the computer is what's called a digital signal processor, a DSP. And we chose that because back in 2001, we could get a lot of processing power for very little electrical power. So by using a DSP. So that's why we chose it. We can use a processor that has very little power and gives us enough computation power to do very interesting things.
I imagine that making these robots small was because you wanted to test them in the ISS, but do you plan on making them bigger for the outdoors?
There is a plan on making them bigger, but it's currently just in the planning stages. And actually, the idea is not to make them bigger, just to keep them about the same size, but be able to go outdoors. There's actually currently a DOD announcement to work on this, what we're calling exospheres.
And what behavior should these robots display when working together, and what applications would those be used for?
Right. The idea of spheres, that the idea is to use multiple satellites, is to test everything of what we call distributed satellite systems. So when more than one satellite are working together. So some applications, a very, very clear one out there with lots of literature research, but no actual satellites yet, is a space telescope. You could, in the future, not with spheres itself, but spheres is your test bed so that you can test and you know how you're going to do it in the future. So in the future, you could have many small satellites with mirrors. And making mirrors is really hard. The biggest mirror we have in space right now is the Hubble Space Telescope. And that's the biggest mirror in a single piece that we will get for many years at least. So for the future, for NASA, even ESA, to make bigger satellites, bigger telescopes, they are thinking about using many small mirrors and making them work together. And as they're working together, we could simulate as if we had a really big mirror, and we could get really good images of planets far, far away. There's another part of it, which is not everything has to be separated. When they're separated, we call it formation flight. But there's also a lot of plans of doing autonomous docking, autonomous rendezvous and assembly in space. So right now, when we assemble the space station, it's very expensive and takes a long time because we have to send a shuttle with many astronauts pretty much any time anything happens. But the idea in the future is if you want to assemble a really big spacecraft, you want to be able to just launch a couple satellites, a couple rockets with some parts of the big spacecraft, and have them come together and assemble themselves. There's only with a couple humans supervising, and you expect everything to work. So that's the other thing we're doing with spheres. Testing algorithms for how we would assemble big spacecraft in the future.
And how do you envision this control of formation flight or of docking?
Okay, so we are studying autonomous control. The idea is that we want humans to have the least amount of work to do. Because ultimately, this type of autonomous control, we know machines can do in general. So we want it to be controlled that the humans, we're using humans for more interesting things that machines can't do. So we definitely want to do autonomous control. And in terms of the actual control system, that's kind of the cool part of spheres, that we can be testing everything. So we have tested algorithms on how to do it in a decentralized way, so each satellite behaves autonomous from each other, or that each satellite works on its own control but with knowledge of what the other ones are doing, or where like a satellite sends information to one central one and that central one determines what everybody else has to do. So there's all these things, rather than just having a gut feeling on how we want to do it, the idea is we can actually start to test it, and we're going to get data, and that's going to tell us what to do.
Do you already have some insight on what is the preferable way to go?
No. We're starting to test, and there's no preferable way. We've done it in many ways, and we've found that a lot of it depends on your mission. So it would be wrong to say that there's a preferred way to go in terms of the control algorithm to use.
And generally, what would you say are the biggest challenges in controlling groups of satellites?
The biggest challenge is that you don't know everything that's going to happen. So even though you try to model everything and make simulations in the ground and have them start to work, once you actually start to run your satellites, there's a lot of things that, this is the real hardware, there's a lot of things that tend to happen, like your communications might stop working for a little bit of time, and you want to be sure that that little bit of time doesn't affect what's happening. You might have gotten wrong some part of your model, of your dynamic equations. So if you do things like that, the biggest challenge is to make sure that the algorithms that you have in there are still smart enough that they're not going to fail. So it's a little bit what we call the field of fault detection and then isolation and recovery. But kind of detecting a fault happens and then being able to recover from it, it's really important. And that will be in many ways the biggest challenge.
And what about docking? What are the challenges with docking? I guess they're very different than formation flying.
More or less. In both fields, another big challenge is going to be sensing. And that's where they're kind of different. Sensing, basically, to know where the satellites are and what they're doing. And with docking, kind of the hardest part is that when you get close together, there's so many things that can go wrong when you're in 6 degrees of freedom, when everything can go anywhere, that it does become quite hard to figure out if something fails at the last minute, what would you do? But even if everything is going right, what we are trying to study is what happens when you're putting together things that are of similar mass. So we in the ground, we constantly do many things that we assemble things, like we assemble cars automatically and machines assemble computer parts automatically. But usually, and even in space, I mean, we're assembling the space station. But when things talk automatically these days, usually it's a really big mass and a really small mass. And that's not what you always want to happen when you're assembling a big thing in space. You want multiple things that are about the same size to start to come together. So when that happens and something goes wrong, two masses of very equal size, kind of if they would crash into each other, it would be a very dangerous thing to happen. Right now, if a small thing crashes into a big thing, it's never good, but it doesn't usually end the whole mission. But if two things of the same size would crash together, then it could end the whole mission, and that's what we're trying to deal with. How do you make sure that you know everything and control them correctly?
So that means you have to be super precise.
You do have to be quite precise, but actually both for docking and for formation flight. In some sense, actually, one of the misconceptions that formation flight, you have to be less precise. And that's not true. If you really wanted to do a telescope that is separated in multiple parts and the parts are flying on their own, you have to be able to control where the mirrors are with respect to each other to fractions of the wavelength of light. So that means about 50 nanometers. So that's about 50 over 1 billion parts of a meter. So you can see that that's very, very small. Instead, when you're docking, what you do is you build a docking mechanism that allows you to be a little bit imprecise when you very, very first make contact, and then it adjusts itself and docks. And usually when we're docking things in space, they are big enough that maybe even like a couple millimeters error would not affect your ability to complete the mission. So in docking, you have to be very precise about the velocity of when you touch each other, make sure the velocity is small enough that nothing bad happens. While with formation flight, you have to be very, very precise on the position. So when things are sitting there, that they have to be sitting there very, very well.
Is the technology there to obtain 15 nanometer precision?
There is, definitely. It's called interferometry. And it's basically when you use lasers, and the lasers have a wavelength in them, all light is ultimately a wave of photons going, basically a sinusoid of photons. And when you have that wave, what we do is we split it in multiple parts, and then when you bring it back together, if they went through different lengths, different distances, one part and the other, when they come back, they're going to interfere with each other. So you can think about it, one is going on the positive side of the sine wave going up, the other one's going on the negative sign. So when you add the two, you literally add them, they could cancel each other. So we measure when things add and when things subtract from each other, and you can measure things to within nanometers. That's not an MIT technology or a spheres technology. That's actually a science that's been around for a while. What we have never done as humans is really have completely free-floating things that can, in fact, close an interferometric loop. So that's one of the spheres research items. We're starting how to close an interferometric loop with a satellite that moves around with big nozzles of gas, and then you have to be controlling things very precisely at different stages.
I'm always amazed that scientists can find ways to test these space robots. I mean, the videos on the ISS are amazing. So how have you been testing the Spheres robots? What's sort of the chain?
Okay. So the way that things happen, it is we have a pretty clearly established chain even in the control world about you make a model of your system. So that's all in the ground, and you're using basically on paper and the computer and MATLAB. You're saying, well, I expect it to move this way. I expect the dynamics to be these ones. And we create the first version of our algorithm. Then we take that and we test it in the ground. In the ground, we have a couple satellites, three satellites that are identical to the ones that are in space station, but they cannot fly beyond gravity, so they're just floating around in an air carriage. It's like an air hockey table, but backwards. Instead of the air coming off the table, the air comes off the puck. And the satellites float on top of those pucks. And that means they can move in two dimensions, which is 3 degrees of freedom. They can move in X, they can move in Y, and they can rotate about Z. So they're moving in these three ways. And we test everything there. And we check that things make sense overall. Now, one of the big hard parts about space is that it's 6 degrees of freedom. They can move in X, in Y, and in Z, and they can rotate in X and Y and in Z. So when we, that's kind of the next big jump that we do to go test in space station. So in our simulation, we do 6 degrees of freedom. We do like three-dimensional motion. Then in the ground, we do 2 degrees of freedom. And then we go back into 6 degrees of freedom in space. And that's when we run the tests that you saw on the videos online.
You've been doing you did parabolic flights in the beginning. Can you maybe explain to those who don't know what those are, how it works, and maybe the experiments you did in there?
Sure. We did those parabolic flights in order to just do a proof of concept of spheres. We wanted to make sure that when we built the spheres that we didn't forget anything. So they weren't really to conduct big science missions. We weren't going to do the big test that you saw on space station. They were really to check that everything overall worked and made sense. So what the reduced gravity flights are is an airplane that is flown by NASA pilots. It goes up to, I think it's 30,000 feet. And when it reaches 30,000 feet, it basically throttles down its engines to zero. It almost shuts, you can think about it almost like shutting off its engines. And it lets itself go into free fall. And when you're free falling inside that airplane, inside the airplane, it feels like microgravity because both the airplane and you are falling at the same time. And the airplane will fall down about 10,000 feet in about 30 seconds. So when there's this drop of 10,000 feet in 30 seconds, you're floating inside the airplane, and again, it feels like it's microgravity. It's not real microgravity because you're still falling and there's still gravity pulling you down, but it feels like it. The only problem with those flights is that, number one, you only get about 25 to 30 seconds, and number two, Because this airplane is falling such a big distance in such a small time, there's a lot of turbulence. So the pilots do have to try to counteract turbulence, and depending on how good the quality of the wind is around us, sometimes it's hard. So many times in the reduced gravity airplane, you get issues where instead of just free-floating in the airplane and not moving around, anything that's not actually attached to the airplane shakes up and down as turbulence hits the plane. So that's why when we began to do this, we decided we needed to do a proof of concept of spheres rather than try to do a full experiment.
Were you on board?
Yes.
Was it nice?
It is quite an interesting experience. It is very fun. You learn about a lot about how to control your body in many ways. I do think that it gave us real insight into how we're gonna, what the astronauts feel when they're up there and why, how the satellites will move when they're up there. It's, in that sense, it is kind of the best thing to have experienced microgravity in order to know how to control it.
Okay, from there you went on to the ISS, basically. How does one get his robot into the ISS?
That is actually a pretty good question. Getting a robot in the ISS, it's not trivial, but it's not impossible either. It's somewhere in between. The idea is that anything that goes to the ISS has to have a research purpose, has to be able to tell us something new about how we plan on working in the future, either in space or in or with humans in the ground. So I would say the first hard part is to think about what is missing in the ISS to help us understand about robots. So that's the first part. And then the next part is to figure out how to get someone interested in one of the different groups that run space station. One group is the NASA/the DOD in the U.S. In the U.S., the Department of Defense has pretty good relationships with NASA because they like to test things in space, too. So there's that combined group, either NASA or DOD, or, these days with National Space Station, ESA has lots of interest in robotics, too, and the Japanese space agency, JAXA, they have a lot of interest in space. So I think that the first hard part is just figure out what can you do in space that we haven't done, right? We kind of figured that out. We said, well, we're going to want to work with many satellites in the future. Nobody's doing that right now, so let's do that. So we kind of found that one. So hopefully some other people will say, oh, well, we're not doing this either, and they'll be able to tell people that that is important.
Can you summarize the results of your experiments on board the ISS?
Sure. First, let me say that we haven't finished, and Spheres is likely to not going to finish for a while. So I can tell you what we've done so far. So far we've been able to do many things that what we call space first that had never been tried before in space. For example, we've been able to do docking to a tumbling target. We said one of our satellites, we told it to rotate and basically not stop. And we had the other one follow it and dock to it. Usually when you're doing docking of two things autonomously, you try to have one be completely steady, not moving at all, and then the other one can dock better to it. But in the future, if we think about docking multiple things, especially if one of them, for example, is a fuel tank and the other one is out of fuel, well, the one that's out of fuel might not be stopped. It might be rotating around. So we did that. Another space first that we did was also with docking, which is we use what's called a path planner. So usually when you have systems work autonomously, everybody knows everything about the system, or you have modeled what's going to happen at the beginning. But that's not what we're looking for. Like I said, some of the things we're trying to find is what do you do when the machine doesn't know? Can you make it smart enough to know where to go? So in this case, what we did is we told one satellite to point away from the other one, but not tell it. We just told it, the other one did not know what the first one was going to do. So it pointed away from it. Once it was pointing to wherever it wanted, then it told it, the first one, I'm here, figure out how to get to me. So the satellite we call the chaser never actually knew how to get to the other one until it was told, okay, I'm here now, now come find me. And that was very interesting because, like I said, we have an older processor with a small computer, and being able to do that was a really big push in autonomous control. Other experiments that we've been able to do a pretty good job with is with formation flight. One of our latest experiments was about increasing the size of a formation. So we began with two satellites moving around in a circle, and then the third satellite came in and joined the formation, and the other two just adjusted their motion very, very peacefully. It looked completely natural for the third one to just come in and everything keep going. You could potentially see how that could be a problem in the future if the other two didn't account for the third one coming in. You could end up with three satellites that are not distributed in a circle. You could even end up with a collision where the third one comes in and the other ones don't know about it, and they could just collide to each other. So basically doing formation reconfiguration, we're kind of the first ones to do it with spheres.
How do you make these robots easy to use for astronauts?
Well, what we did for the astronauts is to make the robots be autonomous. What we do is we use, everything is about testing autonomy operations. So the astronauts are actually never controlling the robots per se. They're just supervising them, which is a very important role. I mean, if the astronauts hadn't been able to supervise the satellites and being able to grab them when something goes wrong, we would have ended the Sirius mission long time ago because we don't always get everything right. So it was actually more about making the best use of humans in space than about making the satellites easy to use for the astronauts. Actually, we wanted the astronauts, we're using the astronauts rather than them using the satellites.
So basically, you upload code to the ISS and they press on, right?
Basically, yes. It takes about 10 minutes to get started. But yes, we upload the code up there and they go through a few processes to load the code. And then the satellites, when the astronaut tells them to start the test, the satellites start the test.
Okay, as you said before, you're not finished with the Spheres project. Where do you see this going in the future?
Well, we have two big things that should happen. One of them is we are increasingly using spheres more and more for educational purposes. We want we don't want only to conduct the research for NASA and DOD, which of course is very important. But in addition to that, we want to be sure that because spheres are so risk tolerant, because we can use them almost as however we want, and nothing can go wrong with the project. One of our big avenues is to get more students, and hopefully a lot of even down to high school students, to work around with spheres and get excited about engineering. So that's one big thing. We want people to be able to spheres to be a big educational tool to encourage people to learn about that. Now, the other side is the research part. And in that, I'm going to split it into two sections, too. First, we're going to continue testing control algorithms and autonomy algorithms for a long time. And many people ask them, well, when are you going to stop? And I tell them, well, we're going to stop when we as a human race can, in fact, launch telescopes that are multiple satellites and that it's only a couple humans controlling them from the ground instead of the huge groups of 200 humans supervising every tiny aspect of that mission. Once we're able to trust autonomy algorithms and control algorithms so much that we just have like two humans press a button, the rocket launches, and then you get the telescope flying in space, that's when Spheres is done, when we really believe this thing. And then in order to get there, the second part is we did make what's called an expansion port on Spheres. So we can attach new tools to spheres that they're small. They should be as small as the satellites, hopefully smaller than that. But, for example, we're going to put cameras on the satellites, hopefully in the next year or two, to fly in up the space station together with the satellites there. So we can start to use vision algorithms in order to do more control. We hope to put on them what's called active docking ports. So when the satellites dock to each other, we want to be able to dock and undock so that we can test real assembly tests of the station. And there's multiple other things going on that we look forward to be able to expand spheres so that it's not just separated spacecraft, but also after you assemble them, that they do something interesting.
When do you think we can start to see the first implementations in reality?
I think we're talking about 15 years away. I think around 2020, 2025, we're going to see a separated spacecraft really take come around in a big way. Obviously, right now, we're going through a stage of where the space is going in a little bit of a what to do, especially with human spaceflight. So I think as we see that humans should only be in space for more useful things, we're going to see a big push for these bigger satellites to start doing the job that they should instead of needing humans.
And what about space robots in general? Do you think there'll be a big push for that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that I'm hoping that after space station sees its lifetime around 2025, I'm already giving it 5 more years than the government wants to, but I'm hoping that just around that time, we are going to be thinking about assembling a new station completely autonomously, and it's going to fully depend on robots doing it. Humans should not have to assemble the next space station. It's going to be assembled by humans, by robots. And if we end up going to Mars, I think we're going to assemble big spacecraft in space that are going to take humans to Mars. And I think those are going to be assembled by robots.
Thanks, Alvar, for being here with us on Robots.
You're welcome.
Before we wrap up, let's continue our discussion on what is a robot. A couple people told us about the CMU definition of a robot dating back to 1979. Adam, want to tell us a bit more about that?
According to the Robot Institute of America's 1979 definition, a robot is a reprogrammable, multifunctional manipulator designed to move material, parts, tools, or specialized devices through various programmed motions for the performance of a variety of tasks. What I think is interesting about this definition is how far we've come in the last 30 years in the development of robotics. In 1979, a robot was simply a manipulator used to move parts in pre-programmed motions, which brings to mind industrial robots used in factories. 30 years later, however, robots are no longer simply manipulators, but can propel themselves in their environment, understand their surroundings, and act according to their particular situation and analysis of surroundings, instead of simply enacting pre-programmed motions. I'd say this 30-year-old official definition no longer applies, so let's try to figure out what robots mean to us today. Keep sending us your answers by email at info@robotspodcast.com. And let's get closer to an all-encompassing definition of a robot for the 21st century. And that's all we have for today's episode of Robots. For more information on today's guests, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Space with Robots, a podcast for news and views on robotics.